loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. President Donald Trump has said he will establish so-called safe zones in Syria. What is a safe zone? How would they be established? And how would this set up the United States for a bigger, deeper, and perhaps illegal intervention in Syria as part of Donald Trump's new foreign policy? Vice President Mike Pence is speaking today at the Anti-Abortion March for Life in Washington, D.C., part of a heavy Trump administration presence at the rally. We'll examine Donald Trump's anti-woman agenda in the first days and weeks of his administration. As the world marks the 50th anniversary of the banning of nuclear weapons in space, is the new rush to militarize space bringing the prospects of war closer to realization? But first we turn to Syria. President Donald Trump has ordered the Pentagon to establish a plan for safe zones in Syria. What is a safe zone? How would they be established? And how would this set the U.S. up for a much deeper intervention as part of Trump's anti-refugee agenda, but an intervention into Syria itself? We are joined to discuss this issue from London by Catherine Shockdom. She is an independent political commentator and author whose latest book is A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. In an interview with ABC, which was his first since becoming president, Donald Trump said, "I'll absolutely do safe zones in Syria for the people." For those who may not understand what a safe zone is, what is it and how would these zones be established?
I think what he was referring to is essentially he wants to create some areas within Syria, pockets, where the American army would actually have control over and would be able to dictate what happens and who flies over and what is basically happening within those territories. So essentially, you are talking about the Balkanization of a sovereign state. And I'm talking about in practice. President Donald Trump can hide behind a certain narrative and argue national security and argue that something needs to be done and that, of course, we need to address the humanitarian crisis, which is taking place in Syria. But you are discussing the trampling again of national sovereignty. And you can't possibly live in a world where we continue to have the likes of Washington to dictate or think that it can dictate what other countries should do and how they should organize themselves and how certain crises should be addressed. It's a very dangerous way to go. It's a very slippery slope. And it's quite troubling. The fact is that I don't think that anyone really picked up on it. People suddenly went on talking about human rights issue and the humanitarian crisis and how immigration is so very bad and that something needs to be done very quickly. But we're not actually talking in practice what it is that it means in terms of international law, what it means for Syria technically on the ground, and actually what it could allow in terms of a precedent. This is quite dangerous because if that was to happen, which I doubt very much, you would then have, you know, the cornerstone of yet another, you know, narrative for Balkanization. But this time, rather than argue counterterrorism, we're going to be arguing humanitarian crisis and interventionism. It's very interesting how this idea of breaking up nation state keeps coming up, but under different banner. But it's always the same story. It has, you know, we always told that something needs to happen and that certain countries need to be broken up into zones or areas or whatever. It's always the same idea. And I found this quite troubling personally.
In the Iraq War, following the 1991 Gulf War, the United States created three parts of Iraq. There were a no-fly zone over the north, which was the predominantly Kurdish area. There was a no-fly zone over the south, over Basra, and the area where there was a larger concentration of a Shiite population. Of course, in Baghdad and in central Iraq, you had a mixture at that time of Sunni, Shiites, and Kurds, all of them living together in Baghdad. But in essence, the U.S. used the humanitarian intervention concept to create these no-fly zones. And that actually, I think this people forget this, that was in 1991 and 1992. And then through the entire decade that followed under Clinton, first George H.W. Bush and then Clinton. So Iraq became fragmented, again, humanitarian intervention. This time, it's humanitarian intervention, as you said, assigning a different noble goal to U.S. intervention, not anti-terrorism, humanitarian intervention. At the same time, Trump says we must keep the refugees out. He's also part of this whole effort is to ban certain Muslims from certain countries from entering the United States. But I want to stick with the issue of what it means for the Trump administration's interventionism, potential interventionism, because many people were hoping, since Trump had said the Iraq war was a mistake and blah, 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 that there would be like something new, like a refreshing break from the endless regime change. But this is what the wording of the executive order, the draft of the executive order. The Secretary of State, in conjunction with the Secretary of Defense, is directed within 90 days of the date of this order to produce a plan to provide safe areas in Syria and in the surrounding region in which Syrian nationals displaced from their homeland can await firm settlement, such as repatriation or potential third country resettlement. But aren't there already millions of Syrians who have been poured into Jordan, into Turkey, for example?
Well, yeah, that's very true. But the second thing is that, first of all, why would Syria, because I don't recall actually Damascus calling for help. So why would Washington volunteer, you know, a solution when the Syrian people haven't asked for anything? And second of all, they're not exactly flocking to the United States either. I mean, you have to remember that there's an ocean in between the two. So for any refugee to want to go to America or actually be even in the capacity of going to America, they would have to be moved through a UN agency. So we're talking about, you know, the immigration issue. There is no real immigration issue. All Mr. Trump would have to do is just to decide to close his border and say, we don't take them anymore. And that would be the end of it. So there is no need to go in Syria and create safe zones or to do whatever, for that matter. The only reason he's talking this way, and I think it's a political posturing, if you ask me, I think he's just trying to remain relevant, because we have to understand that the United States was completely cut off Syria in terms of Syria finding a way towards peace. You had actors such as Turkey, Iran, and Russia involved, and of course Syria, but you didn't have any other country. So the United States was very much sidelined. And I think it's a very sad attempt and a very theatrical attempt to try to give this impression that America is still in control and that Washington is still very much leading the show. Well, it's not even leading from behind in this case. It's just not leading at all, because nobody's listening to what Washington is saying. So I'm not quite sure how, given the fact that he's not president of Syria, I'm not quite sure how his executive order even have some kind of a legal validity in Syria, unless President Bashar al-Assad decide to maybe hand his seat over to Washington, or to maybe just decide to say, you know, why not? Let's do safe zones, you know, in collaboration with Washington. Again, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. And the other dangerous issue is that we're assuming, again, that Syria is not capable, and when I talk about Syria, I'm talking about the state institutions, is not capable of actually taking care of itself when it has been, you know, quite good at pushing against Daesh and actually allowing for its people to find a way forward. So I'm not saying that it's fun to be in Syria right now, but we need to give credit where credit is due. President Bashar al-Assad has done the best he could, given the circumstances and given the fact that everyone has literally tried to destroy his country, attacked his presidency, attacked the institutions of Syria, and tried to disappear an entire system, governance system. So given all this, he's doing pretty well, I'd like to say, because his people are still backing him. And, you know, it's not easy, but humanitarian aid is coming through. So again, I don't understand why we need safe zone. If you want to do a safe zone, I would suggest the following, is that we stop arming, training, and actually offering cover to Daesh militants, because then you would have safe zones. Syria would become an entire safe zone free from radicalism. That would be a good idea.
Yes, I hear you. So let's talk about the different possible meanings of this initiative. You're describing it as partly theatrics, partly an attempt to appear relevant on the part of the United States, when in fact it's not relevant, because the other powers, Turkey, Iran, Russia, in coordination with the Syrian national government, and which also has the support of resistance fighters from Lebanon, from Hezbollah, that they're actually managing the situation. They're in charge of the process. The U.S. is on the outs. But there may be two other possibilities here. One is Trump actually setting the stage, whether he means to or not, but certainly this has its own life in a way once you order this kind of thing, setting the stage for the U.S. military to go in and physically secure parts of sovereign territory or airspace in Syria, and thus actually carried out what you called the Balkanization of Syria, and possibly putting the U.S. in direct competition, military conflict with Syria and Russia. And then there's a third variant that I'd like you to just comment on, and of course it's speculation, because both Turkey and Qatar have said certain positive things, not necessarily formally, but through the media, about the idea of creating safe zones in Syria. Is it possible, given the fact that some people in the Trump cabinet are close to Erdogan, closer to the Turkish government than certainly in the Obama administration, that there's an attempt by Trump to sort of bring Turkey away now from Russia and create a new sort of a new axis that might be interventionist in Syria for different reasons, but united reasons? In other words, the U.S. would have its own interests. Turkey might have its own interests, but there might be a convergence or a congruence. What do you think about that?
Well, let me start with the second part of your question and the Turkish issue. I think it's a possibility. I mean, it would be actually quite clever on Washington's part to try to kind of put a wedge in between Russia and Turkey and to try to play Erdogan's fears and, you know, the Kurdish dossier, which is kind of a big deal for Erdogan, and this fear that, you know, now that Syria is regaining its sovereignty and regaining its strength, that he's going to have to contend with other issues of his own that he doesn't want to deal with. But I don't think it's going to work. And I don't think that you even have enough room for this now, because too many things have happened. Turkey understands now that its place is no longer towards the West, but it's very much anchored eastward. And the only reason being is that Russia and Iran are not in real competition with Turkey when it comes to what matters politically, because they're not after Ankara. They're not after the seat of power. The same cannot be said of the United States or Western capitals. They look at Turkey as a clown state more than they look at Turkey as a partner. And I think that it has been felt so very deeply by Erdogan that I very much doubt that he's going to, you know, repeat the same mistake and actually decide to go against, you know, his own interests. Because in this case, he would actually go against his own interests. And I think he has grown up a little bit and got over the fact that he's not going to have his Ottoman Empire. It's not happening anytime soon. And that the best he could do right now is to actually to try to calm the situation and to build those bridges back if he actually wants to remain in power at all. Now, when it comes to Washington trying to balkanize the Syria and to try to de facto basically enter into a bigger state of aggression, I would say, you know, versus Syria or Hezbollah or Iran, it's not going to happen. I really don't see, and I know that he's, again, he's posturing and he comes across as quite aggressive, more aggressive than President Obama was. I don't think that anyone in Washington is under the impression that the United States Army can take on Russia or Iran, whether they're together or separately. It's just impossible. It would be ridiculous to think that Syria, you know, would be an easy egg to crack. Daesh has tried. It hasn't worked. And I think that it comes from a great degree of arrogance where people continue and nations continue to underestimate the power of resistance. And we're not talking about foreign powers coming in and helping a country. You're talking about a resistance movement, a popular resistance movement, which is anchored in Syria that has received support from other resistance movements, which themselves are anchored in popular resistance and popular legitimacy. There's great power in this. So when you look at Syria, when you look at the whole setup now in the Middle East, you can't really look at nation states divorced from one another. You need to look at nation states within a greater movement, within a greater axis of resistance. Then you would understand that you can't balkanize this. It's impossible now, because I do think that the one element that nobody counted on is that by trying to break up what they thought were, you know, ethnic and sectarian ley lines and trying to explode them and balkanize the region, what they've done is actually cement people understanding that even though they might disagree on many things and they might be very different, they share in this desire to stand free, full stop. And that created the very thing that was missing before, which is this understanding, this nationalism. And now it's there. And I don't think that Washington would be able to explode it, even if he wanted to, even if they had the capability militarily to do so.
Catherine, we have just a little bit more than 1 minute. We're speaking to Catherine Schockdahm. Over the weekend, Trump visited the CIA on his first full day in office. He said, quote, "We should have kept the oil. Maybe we'll have another chance. We should have kept the oil when we got out." Now we're talking about neighboring. I mean, he said this again two nights ago on ABC in his first interview. "We should have kept the oil." I mean, what does it say about the Trump administration, its overall policies? We have 45 seconds now.
Well, it's another form of imperialism. We're talking about capitalism. All they see is American interest, and all they see is natural resources and what they can do with them and how they can siphon them for themselves and for their own interest. Once you understand this, you understand everything about American policy. This is what they stand for. And I think that Donald Trump epitomized what America's policy have become, which is a disturbed form of capitalism and a desire to control everything and everyone under a corporate system. This is how it functions. It's not really a national system of governance. What you have is a corporate system of governance, and it's a very different dynamic.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking from London by Catherine Schockdahm. She is an independent political commentator and author. Her latest book is A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Thank you, Catherine Schockdahm, for joining us once again. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Vice President Mike Pence is speaking today at the Anti-Abortion March for Life in Washington, D.C., part of a heavy Trump administration presence at the rally. This demonstration, this rally happens every year. We'll examine Trump's anti-woman agenda. We are joined by Jane Cutter. She is the editor of liberationnews.org. We're talking to her from Seattle, Washington. And from Los Angeles by Danielle Norwood, an organizer with Women Organized to Resist and Defend, or WORD. Welcome, Jane and Danielle.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
So, Jane, let's start with you. Mike Pence is set to speak at the March for Life, so-called, today in Washington, D.C. It's the first time a vice president will attend the march's 44-year history. Kellyanne Conway, Trump's counselor to the president, will also speak. White House spokesman Sean Spicer has suggested that Donald Trump will call into the rally and said, this is the White House press spokesman, "We will, quote, have a heavy administration presence." This is out and out war by the Trump administration against basic, fundamental, legal and social rights that women have in the United States and, in fact, around the world. Talk about what this means for you as an organizer in defense of women's rights, this heavy administration presence at this annual anti-abortion march.
Well, it's, as you said, it's a declaration of war against women. Abortion is an integral part of women's health care, women's reproductive health care. It's pretty meaningless to be able to otherwise control your reproductive abilities if you can't ultimately terminate a pregnancy that was undesired because no method of birth control is 100% effective. And something like one in three women will have an abortion during the course of their life. Many of those are women who already have children. So this is, you know, a massive attack on women's rights to basically a message of saying we don't care about you and your life. So to say that it's pro-life, and in fact, Mike Pence has a long history of truly being pro-death when it comes to HIV. He has opposed methods and means of reducing HIV, the spread of HIV in Indiana, which we can get into more detail. But it's a complete lie for him to claim that he is pro-life.
Right. That's the vernacular adopted by people who are opposed to women's rights, is that they're pro-life. Of course, Danielle Norwood, they don't seem to be that concerned about the fate of children once born, because these same forces have been also at war against providing necessary social and economic assistance, especially for working class and poor families. You know, let's just talk about this amazing week that Donald Trump has become president of the United States. There was one of his first acts was issuing an executive order to begin to end what is called the Mexico City abortion rule, whereby the U.S. government will deny any federal funds to any country that provides what they call a pro-abortion agenda, but really counseling to women that abortion is one of many possible options for health care. I mean, when he signed it, he was surrounded by very, very rich white men. That's the norm. I mean, talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you can see the photo. It's quite striking. There are eight older white men, I think, you know, gathered around this desk making these very, very serious decisions, you know, that impact so many women across the country. You know, as Jane said, one in three of us will have to seek an abortion at some point. And, you know, we're people too. When we talk sometimes about, you know, the pro-life movement and how they disregard children who are already born, you know, they cut the budgets for health care, for food assistance, you know, anything you can name that helps needy families is being cut right now, including health care. But those one in three women, we're people too, you know, our lives matter too. And often, in particularly the very rare later term abortions, the mother's life is at stake. And many of these new restrictions don't take that into account. And so now they're exporting this terrible ideology that's costing lives around the world, more or less, by saying, you know, we won't provide funds for anyone who even mentions abortion, which is absolutely ludicrous.
Jane Cotter, talk about the origins of the march that's happening today. What's it about?
Well, I mean, it's a march against, essentially, it's a march against abortion rights. And so it has its origins in the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court suit in which abortion was declared to be a private matter between a woman and her doctor. So that's Roe v. Wade. And so these people are protesting the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which is basically was what heralded in the legalization of abortion nationwide. Of course, that's been under attack ever since it came into being, as you can see by the demonstration today. And these reactionary forces have been whittling away at Roe v. Wade through various means over the years, drastically reducing access to abortion in many parts of the country.
Yeah. Daniel Norwood, help the audience, we have a global audience and a U.S. audience, understand what the impact would be when women are deprived of the ability to get a legal and thus safe abortion. I mean, women will get abortions if they need to. Before Roe v. Wade, working class and poor women, I mean, they had to do everything, extraordinary measures, risking their lives, sometimes losing their lives, risking their bodies. Talk about what it would mean to lose abortion rights. And of course, for many women in the country, they already have lost them because of these, as Jane mentioned, draconian state and local restrictions.
Right. You know, one of the things that we know from history is that the amount, you know, the rate of abortion stays pretty steady, other than a drop that we see when we have access to health care, to sex education, to birth control, when women have these options to control their sexuality, their reproductive rights, then we do see a decrease in abortions. We don't see that when we try to block access, when we try to make it illegal. What's going to happen instead? And as you said, in some places, access is already gone, so it's already happening. We're seeing women pursue some different methods, right? Do-it-yourself methods, some of which are safer than others, meaning some of them are getting what they call the abortion pill from other countries. But most of them, I think, are taking matters into their own hands, which is extraordinarily dangerous and a step back. You know, this is what our mothers and grandmothers were fighting to keep us from. And now we're back in this place where we lack the most basic right to control our own bodies and to decide, you know, whether and when we have children.
Jane Cotter, this has been an ideological struggle by the right wing, by the Christian right, by the evangelical right, by the non-religious right wing. Why focus on this issue? I mean, obviously, like when we saw that photo that Danielle was talking about, these eight older men surrounding Trump or with Trump, you know, signing away the Mexico City agreement. Obviously, it's not impacting them. It's not impacting them. Why are they targeting women? Why are they targeting women's rights? And also, as part of the struggle to defend abortion rights, it seems as if the right wing has tried to turn abortion into a dirty word. And as a consequence, the liberals who are defending women's rights and some of the mainstream women's organizations only use other language like the right to choose or reproductive rights. But they, too, shy away from the use of the word abortion. So abortion, in effect, becomes a word that is fairly demonized, and thus that impacts consciousness, it would seem to me.
Absolutely. Well, so you're asking two separate questions. One is why, and I think from a Marxist perspective, which is my perspective, women are, you know, roughly 50%, possibly a little bit more of the entire working class. And if you deprive a vast sector of the working class of our right to control our bodies, we are now essentially distracted and with this massive weight of worry and concern all the time about whether or not my birth control worked. I had a there was a problem. Now I have this pregnancy. You know, what am I going to do? So it becomes this very distracting and depressing, really, in terms of your ability to fight for your other rights. Now we're struggling at this very basic level of, can I control my body? Can I not have children when I don't want to? In terms of the abortion being a dirty word, yes. Liberals in particular have sort of gone along with this idea that, you know, abortion is this thing you can't talk about, and we just talk about choice, and, oh, abortion is so sad and so tragic. Here in Seattle, there's a young woman who's launched a project called Shout Your Abortion, encouraging women to proudly say that they've had an abortion. And so I'll say, I had an abortion. I had an abortion like one in three women in the United States have had abortions. And, you know, it's not like, you know, woohoo, I had an abortion. You know, nobody really wants to go and have a medical procedure done. But, you know, I know it was the right choice for me, and it's the right choice for many women. And as Danielle said, if we have more funding for birth control and sex education, women are more likely to not end up in a situation where they need an abortion, but it is an integral part of full reproductive health care for women to be able to terminate an undesired pregnancy.
Danielle Norwood, you're with the organization WORD, which stands for Women Organized to Resist and Defend. Obviously, women who believe that their rights must be front and center have to resist and defend those rights, because they are the focus of a frontal, massively funded assault, but an assault from the White House itself. What will the movement do? What will your organization do? How can women, obviously tens of millions, hundreds of millions perhaps, want to retain and defend these rights and want to resist? I mean, is it possible that there could be, that all of these attacks could be a catalyst for the revival of a massive grassroots women's movement as existed in the late 60s and early 70s, resulting in the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade?
Well, that's absolutely the hope, is that we're able to organize and come together as a force. You know, as Jane said, we make up at least half the population. And that's just, you know, people who identify as women, right? In addition, we have allies. There are men of conscience out there who march alongside us and who even organize alongside us. So it's not that we lack the power. It's that it's time now to get organized. We saw these huge numbers of women who marched on the White House, you know, all with different messages, it seems like. And I think we just need to have the discipline and the organization to come together on some, you know, points we can agree on, to the extent that we can have a real fighting movement. And, you know, the not the original movement, right, but the earlier women's movement was spurred by necessity. the first domestic violence shelters were opened by women who had been abused and who realized that no such resources existed. And so this sort of underground network of shelters rose. And from that, you know, the sort of critical psychological study of domestic violence came after that. And we began to understand how patriarchal violence occurs on an interpersonal level. And so we could take that and apply it now to these large masses. Maternal mortality rates are rising. You know, people aren't going to be able to feed their kids. Schools are facing these tremendous cuts. And all of these things have a very real day-to-day impact on women's lives. And so I think, you know, we've lost the luxury of sitting at home and liking a post on Facebook or even signing one petition. I think that everyone should get involved in the way that they can, but we need to do as much as we can because this is the time when we have to fight back. I've never seen attacks this overt. And, you know, we've seen some really bad stuff the past, say, 7 to 10 years directed at women. This is the worst I've seen it. This is the most overt. You know, they're coming for us. And I think we have to be ready. And it can't just be the most radical among us. It has to be all of us. And so our task now as a fighting movement, right, is to recruit those people who feel like they don't have a place in the struggle, who think that you have to be incredibly courageous to be part of this movement. We're no more courageous than anyone else. We just kind of see what time it is. You know, we recognize that it's a war and it's either fight back or don't. But either way, they're going to fight. Right. They're going to come after us.
Right. We have just a little over a minute left. Jane Cutter, the country is divided in many ways. It's divided between rich and poor. Half the country is either poor or nearly in poverty. But there's also the red-blue divide. It's in the red states, the Republican states, the states that Trump carried, that the most vicious anti-abortion laws and restrictions are in place. Many of the people in the women's movement or in women's organizations are in the blue states, but there are millions, tens of millions of women who maybe feel politically under siege in the red states because they are red, not socialist red. I mean, I wish they were redder states, but you know what I mean. They're under political siege by the conservatives, the right wing, the Republicans. How can the movement that you two are talking about, how can it reach into the so-called red states?
Well, we have to. We have to talk to those women because they are under the most direct attack, and we just have to figure out a way because we know that they are so under attack. So I think it's just a matter of reaching out and seeking the greatest unity. And, of course, there's divisions, as you mentioned, in our class on so many levels. We also have to make fighting racism a priority in our women's movement. So it's not a single issue thing. We have to find a unity with people on many different fronts. But this is a very fundamental attack on a massive sector of our class.
Okay, that was the voice of Jane Cutter. She is the editor of Liberation News website. It's liberationnews.org if you're interested. We've also been speaking with Danielle Norwood, an organizer with Women Organize to Resist and Defend, or WORD, about the assault by the Trump administration and the right wing against women's rights. We are out of time, but we're going to continue to discuss this story in the days and weeks to come. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. As the world marks the 50th anniversary of the banning of nuclear weapons in space, is the rush to militarize space bringing the prospects of war closer to realization? We are joined by Daryl Kimball. He is the executive director of the Arms Control Association. Welcome, Daryl.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. This is from CNN, just to get started. The Chicago-based Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved the doomsday clock, a symbolic countdown to the end of the world, to 2.5 minutes to midnight. It marks the first time since 1953, after hydrogen bomb tests in the United States and then Soviet Union, that humanity has been this close to global disaster. Those are their words, not my words. It's very concerning, to say the least. Give us your thoughts on that, if you would.
Well, I think the the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist clock is very helpful in reminding us all about the fact that the nuclear threat is still with us. And I agree that the clock should be moved closer to midnight, because even though we've made tremendous progress over the last 7 decades to reduce the nuclear threat and turn back a number of incidents and crises in which nuclear weapons could have used, we're now heading in a direction that is very dangerous. We have a nuclear arms race, a technological nuclear arms race going on, not just between the United States and Russia, the two world's largest nuclear armed countries, but among all of the major nuclear armed countries, including India and Pakistan, which have regular skirmishes along their disputed border in Kashmir. China is increasing its nuclear capacity, and the U.S. and Russia are recapitalizing and replacing their Cold War nuclear weapon systems. And we got to remember that, you know, as we speak, the United States and Russia deploy roughly 1,400 to 1,500 nuclear weapons that can be delivered intercontinental distances on bombers, submarines, and on land-based ballistic missiles. And those weapons can be launched in under 10 minutes by either President Putin or President Trump without the approval or the review of anyone else other than those two commanders in chief. So we're living in a situation in which there are a number of nuclear tripwires, tensions between the major powers are growing, and nuclear weapons capabilities are being replaced, or they're being improved rather than moving towards global zero.
So how does it actually work? I mean, the U.S. and Russia each have, as you say, around 1,400 ICBMs, missiles that can reach each other. In other words, go long, long distances. And they're based on different platforms, whether they're in submarines or land-based missiles or in fighter aircraft. You're saying if Donald Trump, for instance, gave the order to carry out a nuclear attack, that there's no stopping it?
That is correct. And because of the nature of U.S. and Russian nuclear planning, the commanders-in-chief have basically sole authority to order a launch in response to a real or suspected attack on their country. So, for instance, if the United States North American Defense Command, NORAD, detected a incoming objects that looked like Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles, they would immediately alert the White House, the Pentagon, Strategic Command in Omaha, Nebraska, and in Colorado, that they see this. They would brief the president on the options to respond if this is indeed a nuclear attack. Those options are pre-cooked, not as if there's discussion about exactly what to do. There's like option A, B, and C. And the president would be told in very short order, in under 2 minutes, that he has about 2 or 3 minutes to decide whether to launch some or all of the United States arsenal in retaliation before the United States nuclear weapons are destroyed by these incoming missiles. So this kind of launch under attack posture, which both countries have, create the possibility of miscalculation in a crisis if there's a false warning. I mean, there have been false warnings in the past. Or in the event of a real conflict between the two countries, like something that could erupt in, you know, over the Baltic Sea region, over Ukraine, or somewhere else in the world, there could be an escalation of hostilities that leads each side to alert their nuclear forces and consider employing nuclear weapons if they feel desperate enough to have to launch them. So this is the situation in which we continue to live. And so, you know, this is what the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists team is warning us about. They are reminding us that the world still lives in this nuclear sword of Damocles hanging above us, as John F. Kennedy put it in 1963. And we need to take steps to reduce these risks, reduce the excess nuclear stockpiles, and to prevent further development and improvement of the nuclear weapon systems by these other countries around the world.
I don't think there's the kind of public consciousness right now that there used to be about the danger of nuclear war, certainly since the end of the Soviet Union, following its collapse in 1991, the end of the so-called Cold War. The whole way things are presented and viewed, I'd say, by people, and especially people who were born since then or shortly before then, there's just not the sense of alarm that the world could be sort of impacted in the most grave way by nuclear weapons. I know as a child, I was doing the duck under our desks and preparing. We had normal drills, but I was from that era. So, we were all thinking about it. We lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis where we felt maybe there would be thermonuclear war. But now there's a sort of sense of benignness, it seems to me, about the whole issue, like not a sense of alarm. So when you tell people, hey, the doomsday clock just got moved forward, it sounds alarming and maybe alarmist. But from your point of view, and as we talk about it, it must seem to the audience that this is real, either because of intent or because of accident or both. And also, there's an unsettling of world affairs right now. The world order that had some equilibrium during the Soviet Union-U.S. confrontation, it doesn't have equilibrium. It's appearing to have more and more unmanaged rivalries. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there's certainly less awareness today in 2017 than there have been at other times in the history of the nuclear age. And that's understandable in part because there are other serious issues that we face globally, climate change, migration and refugees. We know more about the conflicts around the world today than maybe we did 30 years ago when we didn't have social media and journalists being able to penetrate and report on events. And there is, the United States and the Soviet Union are not the two leading powers in the world today. They are among the leading powers. So the United States is still the preeminent power, but there are other actors. And so, yes, it is a different situation, but because it is different, we have a multipolar world because there are more problems. The nuclear danger is in some ways it's greater, or there are more nuclear problems to pay attention to and for the United States to help manage and reduce. What I haven't mentioned is that also another threat, which is the possibility that a non-state actor, a terrorist organization, could obtain a small quantity of plutonium or highly enriched uranium to make a crude nuclear device. This has been a concern since the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and this was a major priority for President Obama. There were four nuclear security summits, global summits, to better secure nuclear material, but there's more work to be done. And the other thing I would just say that's different about this problem than many of the other global problems we face today is that the catastrophic consequences of nuclear war make everything else that we're concerned about globally kind of pale in comparison. So in other words, if things go wrong, they will go terribly wrong. And, all it takes is the use of a few hundred nuclear weapons to cause not just the destruction of a nation. For instance, the conflict between India and Pakistan could certainly destroy the major population centers in those two countries, but it would also create global climatic effects that would extend well beyond the borders of those two countries. That would have ripple effects on food production. It would have effects on the global economy, et cetera. So that is why the stakes are very high and why we need to pay more attention to this issue today than we may have thought we should.
That's the voice of Daryl Kimball. He is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Arms Control Association. Daryl, 50 years ago today, the Outer Space Treaty, or the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and other celestial bodies, was signed in Washington, London, and Moscow. Talk about what the basis of the treaty, what was the basis of the treaty? What did it accomplish? And also now it seems to me, and I'm not, I have no expertise in this field, but I do read in the popular media that in various countries, in Russia, in the United States, perhaps in China, there's a lot of talk about the need for military superiority or the fear of one country getting military superiority in outer space. In other words, that's the new front line in possible modern warfare. So talk about those two things, if you would.
Well, the Outer Space Treaty was a response to the increasing competition between the United States and the Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s to be first in space, to win the space race, to send a man to the moon. And so beginning as late as the 1950s, the international community was concerned that the United States or the Soviet Union might station nuclear weapons in space that could be used to hit objects on Earth. And so over the course of about a decade, the international community discussed this problem. And finally, in 1966, after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, the U.S. and the Soviet Union reached an agreement not to place nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction in outer space. So this was a key part of the effort to try to make sure that space is safe for science, technology, communications. It would not become yet another realm in the Cold War battlefield, so to speak. And so it was very important because it allowed the U.S. and Russia it opened the door for them to cooperate in space later in the 70s. There was the common effort with Soyuz to put Russian and American astronauts in space together. So, but today there are some other risks and dangers in outer space. We now are very reliant upon the satellites that are in orbit around the Earth for virtually everything that we do every day: communications, our GPS systems on our smartphones are reliant upon satellites, and more. And there's the possibility that if there's a major explosion or disruption in the atmosphere and in the near outer space, it could severely disrupt the peaceful use of space and all the things that we depend on. And so the U.S. and the Chinese and the Russians, which are the primary spacefaring nations, have been putting forward competing ideas about how to preserve and protect space. The Russians and the Chinese want to ensure that the United States does not position other kinds of weapons in space. They are concerned about putting together a new treaty to prevent an arms race in outer space. The United States has a different approach to this. The United States is concerned about making sure that our military satellites and other countries have military satellites are not interfered with, but at the same time, we are not limited in using space to guide our terrestrial military operations. So there are competing ideas about how to protect space in the future for peaceful purposes. And, this is a new area of competition that we have to watch out for. I would also just note that, with the increasing proliferation of ballistic missiles, several different countries, there are more countries now that have the theoretical capability of knocking down satellites in space with these land-based ballistic missiles. And that is a threat in the future. In a conflict that might occur on the ground, one or more country could try to knock out the opponent's satellites in space using ballistic missiles.
Let me just ask you real quick, because we only have now 1 minute. The time goes so fast. Addressing the U.S. global missile defense system in October, Russia released an official statement talking about the ability of the U.S. to, quote, destroy the Earth's artificial satellites on low orbit. That's what you're talking about. The Russian statement also added, I mean, from a Russian point of view, the Americans probably say the same thing about Russia. I don't know. You can clarify. Moreover, given the global nature of the actions of the ships equipped with interceptor missiles, the U.S. will be able to interfere in the space-related activities of any country. Are those legitimate concerns? Are they universal concerns? Does the U.S. have the same concerns that Russia has?
Well, Russia is in general concerned about the United States' efforts to create missile interceptors that can knock out a small number of offensive nuclear-armed ballistic missiles from a state like Iran or North Korea. Their concern, the Russians, are that the United States will expand this system in such a way as to be able to knock down a portion of their ballistic missiles, their offensive nuclear-armed ballistic missiles. And so that is what's behind those criticisms. But it's also, as I said, theoretically possible for Russia or China or India or Pakistan or the United States, all of which have ballistic missiles that can reach the outer atmosphere to knock down satellites if there were to be a conflict between a couple of countries. So the space could become a realm of conflict in that way. On missile defense, it's important to remember that if you build defensive missile systems, it can encourage the further development of offensive ballistic missile systems to overwhelm those defenses. So ballistic missile defenses are not a cure-all. They're not a solution for increasing offensive nuclear weapons competition.
Yeah, reciprocity is a given, I would guess, if one side tries to get the advantage over the other. And thus, a new arms race. We've been joined by Daryl Kimball. He's the executive director of the Arms Control Association. I encourage our listeners to go to their website to learn more about an issue that's so important and yet not that covered in the media or certainly in the mainstream media. We've been talking on the anniversary of the signing of the Outer Space Treaty. Well, that's all the time we have. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.